stable mutual actualization. That's what my guest Rocco is after. He believes with the use of true reason, a mature, sophisticated, objective reason, which was his most important value, that we as humans have the ability to achieve a stable state where mutually all of us can self-actualize into what we want to be. And you can contrast that with the world he sees today, where most people, if not all, actualize at the expense of someone else. We mostly just follow our base instincts to try to live the best life we can imagine, without acknowledging the fact that our instincts and our imagination are fallible. If that sounds heavy, if that sounds complicated, if that sounds nuanced, I agree. This was a heavy conversation. But I wouldn't say it was abstract or theoretical. I think in a very logical and pragmatic way, Rocco's trying to figure out how humanity can save itself from itself. As a way of background, he's an Australian philosopher, poet, and podcaster, among other things. And in his words, he has an unorthodox and autodidactic mastery of human psychology, which provides cutting and insightful observations. I mean, if I had to put it simply and just bluntly, Rocco thinks he sees things others don't see in the world. He believes he has a gift to understand humans and the things that plague us, the things that cause unnecessary suffering in the world. He also believes he has a heart that's committed to trying to make the world a better place and an ego that can submit itself to logic and reason rather than his own, you know, personal comfort or happiness or other self-serving needs. I'll be the first to say, and you'll hear it in the conversation, like that all sounds pretty amazing. But as they say, that's why we play the game, or in this case, that's why we do the show. These are the exact type of people I want to question. I want to pressure test. I want to just explore all these different ideas, because I agree with Rocco completely that we are plagued by a lot of different things. There are tons of issues that face humanity today, as many have historically as well, but there's some unique ones today. So I think we have to probe, we have to challenge. And it was really thought-provoking to kind of explore some of the assumptions, some of the implications, trying to understand tactically, what do we actually do to improve? How do we actually make this world a better place? I hope you guys enjoy this one as much as I did. It left me with a lot to think about, and something tells me this won't be the last conversation I have with Rocco. But I think this conversation on two really important levels highlights, one, what it looks like to actually try and examine ourselves as humans, how we function, how we work at kind of a macro level, but also at the individual level, trying to understand how we try and understand those things. How do we navigate the flaws of our own mind, our own ego, our own issues, our own confidence and certainty at times? How do we question ourselves effectively? So a big thanks to Rocco for being on. And with that, let's get to the episode. All right, Rocco, thank you so much for being here. Real psyched to talk to you today.
Thanks for the invite.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. Happy to have you. I'll get right to it with that first question of, what's the value that's most important to you?
What is the value that's most important to me? It's reason. Reason. I think we're stuck at the moment collectively in a place that we can't seem to reason each other or ourselves out of, because I don't think we reasoned our way in there. And think for me, like if I could capture one thing that I'm trying to focus on, advocate for, push through the door, package in different ways, sell in whichever possible way, is this idea of stable mutual actualization. Mutual. It's a mouthful. Yeah. But the name's written, or the meaning's written right there on the tin. Stable mutual actualization. And I think we've got something else that we're busy cranking out, much to our detriment. I think it really matters. In fact, at this moment, right now, I don't think anything matters more than that.
That's a beautiful start. Explain that, though. So stable, mutual.
Sure. Most of us will be familiar with Abraham Maslow's work. He was talking about self-actualization. Scott Barry Kaufman also had a really awesome addition to that, which we can maybe talk about later. But the basic premise is this: you've got a pyramid of objectives, needs, things that impel us in our activities, our interactions with each other and with the world. And primarily at the bottom, it's your basic physiological needs, sleep, sex, shelter, defecation. You got to have somewhere to rest. You got to have something to eat. You got to have a mate. And you've got to be able to do what your body does. And then each rung from that upwards becomes a little bit more nuanced. The second one up is to do with security, property, means, wealth, until you've got the social and esteem needs. And they are very much cohesive needs in a society. And then right on top, there's this little point. And I think that little point's misunderstood a lot. It gets, we attribute the same thing to the sociopathic CEO of a corporation as we do to an impressionist painter that cuts the ear off. This person actualized, you know, they're really crushing it in life. But often the way that these people are actualizing, like if you have a husband and wife, they're basically a team, a social team. And he's on the golf course first thing in the morning. He's actualizing. He's improving his swing. He's playing the back nine like a champion. But he's actualizing at the expense of. And we have a lot of people currently actualizing at the expense of. And this is absolutely not a political diatribe. I mean, I think they've all got it confused, both sides of the argument. But the most generous version of the argument from the disenfranchised progressives, the people wailing about pronouns and things like that, the most charitable argument from them is that for a long while, someone was getting along well, but we weren't. Someone was free too, but I wasn't. and I've got compassion for that because that's a very human stance that says very basically something's unfair. And the whole American dream, for example, was built on this premise that every human has a right to safety, freedom, the pursuit of their interests and property. And our property doesn't always need to be physical. Sometimes it can just be the kind of intellectual property or emotional capital that we need to be able to pursue what we want to do. And not everybody's free to do that. And it's very clear in our organized societies or our disorganized societies that not everyone actually has the same starting point, the same opportunities, the same. Now, I'm far from being a raw-boned egalitarian. I do believe we should all have something that's more egalitarian than what we have at the moment, but I don't think we should stumble politically blindly towards that direction either. But I know what I'm doing here, and I'm part of a whole. And the whole that I'm part of, I have so much to thank for the amount of time and energy I'm able to dick around doing the things that fill my cup. You know, if you get six people together or one person living on their own on the savannah, he's got to collect firewood, he's got to collect water, he's got to collect something to eat, he's got to protect himself at night. Suddenly, when you scale those numbers up, even small groups, 6-10 people, the emergent property is that 10 people can do significantly, exponentially more than those 10 individuals would have been able to collaborate through manpower, availability, time, bandwidth, concentration, etc. And as our groups got bigger and bigger, we eventually transcended this Dunbar's number, this call it 125, 120, 150. It doesn't matter that the number's been adjusted. Double it if you like. Even, you know, begin with 300. There does get a threshold where it becomes significantly more difficult to make that group cohesive. And so you need shared stories. And our shared technology like language and our shared capability of being able to transmit and abstract ideas and plan for the future and abstract with time that way and build relationships specifically between cause and effect. I mean, that's the fundamental nature of superstition, of morality, and of science. We're trying to understand what are you doing here that's going to make an outcome over here. So there's a couple of questions, you know, where should we be headed? There's some argument about that. You know, what does good look like? And the other argument is, how should we get there once we decide what it looks like? And when you free people up in a society like ours, specialization emerges. Now the guy that grows apples and the guy that makes shoes and the guy that fetches water, each of these people can do these things in a highly specialized way because they don't have to spend all their energy duplicating a bunch of redundant tasks that somebody else is doing. What do human beings do with their bandwidth? They take this one thing that they're jacked up about, that maybe their father used to do, making shoes or growing apples, and they get really good at it. And all the advances that they make, eventually these advances spill the banks of your narrow channel of interest. And now the whatever you learned with fruit farming can now be applied to different forms of agriculture, or whatever you learned about this can now enhance that. And of course, all these technologies all start coming together. But the thing is, so what you have is you have this like collective intellect that far exceeds our individual intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And this collective ingenuity and capability and discoverability and all of these things which we value as human beings, our collective is better at it than us. But individually, we can still all be quite ignorant.
Yes.
For example, the people that built the pyramids, they must have had complicated understanding of engineering and mathematics and geometry. They must have had.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not to say that every single person that was making a mud and clay brick or lugging a weight up a hill on log rollers, not every single one of them was innately embodied with this ability to do these complex calculations. That was specifically the reason, because there was a pyramid-based structure of human beings, and the ones at the bottom were doing the toil and soaking up the shitty bandwidth so that the ones at the top could direct their bandwidth towards these high projects. Some version of that is happening everywhere. The problem is...
Okay, can I ask a question there, Rocco? Just to play it back to you.
Yeah,
you know, we're tracking on the same. So the stable mutual actualization that you're speaking of, there's a belief that if we use reason, if we use the reason, the gift of reason that we all have, if we think about it, if we problem solve this in the right way, we can address that problem of cohesion, even given the size and scale that the population's grown to. We can find a way to make it where we can achieve that state, where people's actualization doesn't come at the expense of somebody else, right?
That's exactly right. It's both stable and mutual, yes.
Both stable and mutual. The question, I guess, has to be, is that sounds amazing in theory. Is it realistic? Mm. Is it actually feasible and possible? Because the pyramids, right, we can go through human history. Is there any evidence that gives us confidence that that's actually an achievable state?
Well, insofar as individual human beings can conceive of the idea and collaborate in the interest of an outcome, yes. The problem is we need to reason beyond the restrictive and, by definition, conflicting nature of our individual narratives and stories. So is it possible? Yes. Is it likely given our current trajectory? No, of course not. But there is precedent that makes me hopeful. So if you look in the corporate world, which is much of the problem, they're good at a bunch of things. And if it has to do with finding new ingenious ways of doing things efficiently, they find it because that's what ultimately the incentive is driven for, so that they can make more and more shareholder return. So you get what you incentivize. Now, one of the things that they came up with, I wouldn't say it by accident, but I don't think they realized what they were doing when they were doing it, is this philosophy of agile. I don't know if you're familiar with agile.
Yeah,
great. Now, Spotify uses agile to create iterative solutions and push it out. And they kind of test in production. It's not like they've got a separate test environment with 7 or 4 billion listeners. This ecosphere that they release their solutions into is the ecosphere. But when something doesn't wrong, when something goes wrong in the software, you don't crack the shits and cancel your Spotify subscription. You assume that there's a bug and you raise it. And then you look at the bug log and somebody's trying to fix it. And the person that's doing the transcription of the latest releases and the person that's doing the fixes and the person that's doing some interconnection software with Sonos or with Bose speakers, these are not the same teams. They've got specialist teams working on different things. And the reason that they're able to keep pace with the growing demand is because they take this heuristic, which I think is a very sophisticated heuristic of, as soon as I know better, I do better.
Hmm.
Near enough is good enough for now, on the condition that I'm going to mop up and clean up behind me or I'll make the necessary adjustments when I come. Everything's baked into user stories where I'm delivering minimum value. There's a different heuristic that's not emotional when it comes to deciding what better looks like and where, which way we're going to lean and how we're going to get there. You democratize that to a degree to people who make it their specialist job to worry about the size of the button that you're going to click on when you want it to play. And not everybody has to weigh in emotionally and make up stories about how it offends them or how it offends Jesus. People are just getting on with things and this product keeps emerging. Now, our problem is that when we take something even as far-sighted as a constitution, it's a universal statement that systems fail when their inputs exceed their throughput. The justice system, the human cognitive system, your internal bowel plumbing. If you overload that with too much input, the system will fail because the input will exceed the throughput. That simple. And our means of moderating our operating system and our collective ideas, we're not doing it in an agile way. We're not getting together in scrums, trying things, and then giving it a go and putting it out in the world and saying, okay, that didn't work, let's tighten it up, and collaborating in the interests of solving the problem. We're pseudo collaborating in the interests of scoring points to make sure that our side on this horizontal spectrum looks right, never elevating the conversation vertically, always just staying on that baseline. And so is it possible for human beings to collaborate in the interests of an outcome that isn't perfect in the beginning, but keeps trying to lean that way? It seems evident. Need to find the wit to join the two modalities together. You know.
Is the difference though in that in the Spotify example, there is an objective outcome that we're working towards, right? And we could debate what that is.
But there isn't. Well, there isn't.
Isn't, well, let's talk about it, right? Is it not in Spotify's case to ultimately increase the value of the company, to increase, call it revenue, call it what you will, so that when you're going through that agile process of trying to be better and do better, right? Because we're getting into the traditional kind of cliched philosophical issues. Like, what does it mean to be better? What does it mean to have a good outcome? The benefit that Spotify has is that they can place an objective answer on that. So as you're failing and learning and growing and being agile, you have a marker to reference to see if you're getting better against. Versus when we look at stable mutual actualization, the problem there is there's not an objective answer on what actualization should be.
No, right? Nor should there be.
Okay.
Nor should there be. So, I mean, when Spotify began, mm-hmm. I guarantee you they had no idea that their software was going to look the way it does today.
True. But they did know what their goal was, to build a company that could.
Yeah, but their goals kind of changed as they've gone. It hasn't remained static.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in Agile, you have things like user stories. And what you're doing is you're building feature by feature and capability by capability. And yes. It's a mixture of listening to the stakeholders, but also acquiescing to the market.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, there's other competitors also building shit like this.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're all building for the same reason, by that definition, it would suggest that every single music service and streaming company, their interface looks exactly the same and does exactly the same thing. Because after all, they're all trying to make money and they're all servicing a music listening public. However, the way Tidal tackles it and the way Spotify tackles it are slightly different. And their ethoses might be slightly different and their humanitarian angle might be slightly different and their vision for the future might be slightly different. And just like the ship of Theseus, all you do is you take out one plank, one C-level board member, and you replace it. Is it the same board? Yes, it is, but it is different. And then just like the ship of Theseus, the part that usually bakes everybody's noodle is, let's say you in time replace every single plank on that ship of Theseus. But instead of those planks rotting, you just replace them systematically over 10 years. And you put all the planks over here in a pile. And you rebuilt the same ship. But the one that's sailing on the water with Theseus at the helm with his flag on it, everyone says that's the ship of Theseus. Whereas on one factual perspective, if you take every single one of those board members and every single one of those employees and you fire them and sack them and replace them over time. And you actually make Spotify 2 over here. People do this.
Mm-hmm.
The product that emerges, the ethos that emerges, is never identical to this one. These people say, we've learned our lessons. This actually left a bad taste in our mouth. We're going to do something completely different. Now, I don't know what better looks like. Neither do you. And the reason why people debate endlessly is because we're two tiny people speculating in an absolute void of not knowing. And that is not the way to go about smartly investing time to decide what to do. You break the problem down and you allocate it to people who you whose job it is, whose interest it is, to get at that piece. And I'm not suggesting you rejig America and you break it up into agile squads, but certainly the way we're going without even considering a realignment, a reconfiguration, to suggest that the Constitution is inept given the current judicial and the current way it gets argued and moderated, an amendment gets added. Life is changing. The rate at which life is changing is outstripping our ability to catch up with legislation and moderation. So if, let's say, for example, there were some important amendments that we actually needed to have about how to look after the purple head crazies on the far left, or how to keep the religious radical right placated to a degree, and something that was middle ground and fair, even if it was actually going to get us some step forward into something healthier, whatever it was, we think we're interested in politics. That's what we say we are. But if you ask anybody, even a really animated person who claims to be interested and animated by politics, what's the name of your governor? What was the last two pieces of legislation that were passed in your state? They haven't got a fucking clue. But you know what they do know? They know who AOC was. They know who Bernie Sanders is. They know who Marjorie Taylor Greene is, because they know the main actors in the reality TV. And so while that reality TV show is the entertainment, arousal, agitation machine that is also now supposedly being delegated this quite highbrow role of arguing policy revision and legislation, have a guess what's going to happen, man. It's like a bunch of teenagers, right?
But, do you, how do we know that in the way that you're saying it, I think, but correct me if I'm hearing it wrong.
Yeah.
It's like the watching of that reality show, the focusing on just the stars, not actually understanding it, not using reason to truly understand it, has caused the problem that we have. How do we know, like, but how do we know it's not the other way, in that we have that problem because it's inevitable? Like, people,
are you seriously trying to tell me that
possibly, but go ahead,
if we wanted to do something that was good or slightly better for everyone, that we would design a political system with two parties that were incentivized to tear each other down every 4 years, blame everything in the interceding 4 years on the other team, and get everybody riled up to the point that no one could find any middle ground? Do you think, are we seriously saying that as a whole species, our best gambit?
I'm saying I would never say anything with any certainty like that. But what I'm saying is, if we've gotten here, we have to entertain the idea that we got here because there was no other, there's not a better way that we're capable of, right? That's kind of where we started. In theory, I think you could make a lot of points, as you have, beautiful points, that seem to be better. But when you start to layer in all the complexity of the world, the unknowns, as you mentioned before, the limitations of the human mind, the flaws of the human mind, is it actually possible to achieve that better theoretical state, or is this actually the best we can do?
Well, I'd like to believe this isn't the best we can do. And
I'd like to believe that too, but is that...
Sure, and I think what might happen is our existential survival might depend on us finally taking that question seriously.
True. But we sit here, you and I, in April of 2023 with this sensation that, like, we have to figure this out. We just have to. But there's been thousands of years of human history, which I imagine there's been two people having a very similar conversation saying, there's got to be a way to do this better, right?
Yeah. But, so surely something will come. Yeah.
Right. But how can we, I understand the optimism and the desire for the hope that there has to be something better than this. But don't we have to consider there's not? That this is actually just the best we can do, as dark and gloomy as that is?
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying we have to, but I think it's an intelligent starting point that we can steel man or straw man and either live with or reason our way out of.
Agreed.
And
I agree with that.
If we, yeah. And so, you know, I'd rather act as if better exists and try to lean that way than consign myself to the fact that it doesn't. Because there's one of those two ways is more sure of finding the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of the things we learn through metaphor. You know, there was this kingdom and then they broke away and then another kingdom started, but they basically were modeled on the same structure and so on and so on and so on and so on. And every now and again, some of the metaphor that we base our learning on, we don't do because of, we do in spite of. In fact, like the way I raise my children is not because of how my parents raised me. It's in spite of the way my parents raised me, because the kind of leader I was when I was in corporate was not because of all the great leaders I was given to follow. It was, okay, that I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. Fuck that. And eventually you built this like negative space synthesis of, okay, this is what I think a leader actually ought to be, which was none of what you all did. So we have those uses for analogy and metaphor, but in the service of understanding and learning things, I mean, at the end of the day, the only real limit to what humanity can achieve is knowledge, really.
So
at the end of the day, science works because of science. The universe works because of universal laws and physics, and the fact that we don't have the instruments to measure them. 50 years ago, we would never imagine life would look the way it does at the moment. So technological progress can actually give us these extensible technologies that helps us understand more. Maybe some barrier will be encountered that we can't beat, but our problems right now are not technological. They are cooperation problems. We can't cooperate.
Let's get into that for a second. So let's look at it from that angle. So what if we believe, and let's go with it, because I think it's a right point to make, that we have two choices. We can either say it's hopeless and just kind of bury our heads in the sand and just it's shit, or we can say I believe there's possibility for a better way if we use reason. So let's assume that's what's stopping us right now? Like what are the issues that are, if it is possible, what's preventing us? And I mean that at like a very first principles level, right? I know there's
for sure.
Is it that has stopped us from getting there to this point in history?
So a root cause analysis. Why is this happening? Because we can't agree on shared common intentions or incentives.
Okay, I buy that. And let's play that.
Why that? Well, because we have two factors working against us. Very primitive human nature,
mm-hmm.
which is always coming along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, your higher nature that applies reason and executive function on top of that doesn't come along. It's got no autopilot function, doesn't come along for the ride. You literally have to go and fetch it. You have to learn critical thinking. Yeah. You have to learn what logical fallacies are. You have to learn how to slow down and pass things slowly. And of course, in the billion years of evolution, the 1.25 million years of evolution that we've gone through as a species, what's his name? Tim Urban puts it beautifully. He said, if the whole of human history from that point was a 1,000-page book and you teleported somebody of page 600 onto page 700 and every page is 250 years, no technology change, no structural change, no cultural change. Everything's exactly the same. Maybe you just have to make new friends. Now you can't jump a line ahead and recognize the world around you. And everything of any note that defines us literally happened in the last three pages. So you've got this backlog of human nature for 999 pages of how we behave like absolute freaking selfish savages.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason we were able to be cohesive was because we got these very primitive operating systems, DOS 3.1 or first version of Linux. And this was our superstitions and our tribal cultures and our agrarian cultures. And we went through all these operating system updates. But they were tiny little increments on each other. And eventually they started bleeding into each other as the East bled into the West. And it was a shitstorm. And it was, and none of the pull requests from, are we going to steal this bit from your operating system and take this bit? None of that was done consciously or intelligently. It kind of just spilled together, right? And so now we've all got here to this point. We've got, on the one hand, an absolute overwhelm of signal coming at us. Do this, listen to this, watch this. Our attention, our means for filtering and focusing out, whatever place we're going to use to start qualifying intelligent questions, pursuing intelligent answers, overriding our own natures. That little well, that little beachhead in Normandy is completely overwhelmed, completely. But then we've got our human nature, which is easily triggered. It's predicated for finding vigilance, tribalism, other. So any problem that occurs, everyone's just going to nucleate into factions automatically, intrinsically.
Mm-hmm.
And what is standing against us is this massive distended imbalance between, so we've got Iron Age superstitions, which basically that's our world religion, mm-hmm. basically. We've got Paleolithic emotional competence.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got Jetsons level technology that's democratized, increasing exponentially, allowing us, the worst versions of ourselves, to project ourselves and our opinions onto a shared market space of attention and ideology. Everything, every system that we have for processing this is out of sync and overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking outside of ourselves for an enemy, the other, to blame, because ideologically our psychology was programmed with the idea that either a messiah must come, somebody else will solve the problem. Don't worry, it's going to be Elon Musk, it'll be Trump, it will be some messianic figure is going to come along and it shall all be well, because the children want that. And on the other side, the left, they don't want a messiah. Fuck that noise. They want a scapegoat, which is really the flip side of the same coin. It's the either I'm looking for the greater other outside of myself or the piece of shit other outside of myself. And this one's either going to come and redeem my unworthiness or everything that I can't handle inside of myself because I was brought up this way. I'm going to find someone who's to blame, who's doing a microaggression against me, and I'm going to pour it all on them. We're going to whip this person, cancel culture them out into the wilderness and make sure they take all of our sins with us. And we never feel well, so we go looking for the next one.
So we're
it's human nature, basically. Undiagnosed human nature is.
So where's the optimism come in then? Where's the belief that we can be better, that we can overcome?
Well, I'm probably more of an intelligent cynic than I am an optimist. But look, at the end of the day, I'm a reluctant leader, a thought leader in this, and I'm not leading because I'm brazenly optimistic and I think I've got all the answers, but I'm sure there's much more intelligent, much more capable people than me that should be wrestling with these questions. I just can't seem to get their attention for long enough because they're arguing about the small fry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, this team is going to face this team off in the finals. And Jesus, have we got a lot of planning and game planning to do? Yeah, but what color are the laces going to be? I don't care. Have one of each kind. Like, try this color in the first half and that in the second half. I think that's the wrong problem.
Yeah.
But what makes you say this is the right problem? And the problem is, it took two intelligent, well-meaning. We were trying to converge. You actually... Trying to understand someone else requires some effort, but commensurately less effort than trying to be understood. Mm. And the people trying to be understood are doing all the work. Because the person that's expected to try and understand, they have been taught that this lawyer style of rhetoric, win at all costs, cheap shots. It doesn't matter what you believe or what is true or what is right. What matters is winning this case. That's it. That's what I'm here for. And so rhetoric, through that wall of rhetoric, Yeah, I'm not actually that optimistic, but when you wake up to the gravity of this problem, you don't have the courtesy of going, well, it's pretty big, so I'm just going to let it pass me by. Because that's not, now that I'm actualizing, and this is the thing, actualization isn't something you can begin at with the project of trying to get everyone aligned. You can't do that. Actualization has to begin here. And so the relationships that you foster have to foster stable mutual actualization. You have to park your shit, get over yourself, square off your crap, do your inner child work, process your generational trauma, integrate your shadow, whatever it is, all this mess that lives below the surface, this 998 pages of backlog. Bear in mind, I don't want to steal Tim Urban's idea. He's got a new book out. Go read it. What's Our Problem, it's called. And but that metaphor explains it all. We've got to leaf through our own book as far back as we can go to pick up the this caused this and this caused that and that caused this. And how much crap did we cause along the way here? Somehow I have to wear this. I'm not saying it's going to be financial reparations. I'm saying, just as a human being, what would you want? What would you want?
Yeah, you'd but want someone. Isn't that it, though, Rocco? Because I can get on board with what you're saying. I think it makes a lot of sense about the, we need to do our own work, right? I think reason, where you started with, as the value, let's just use that term for it. I think you and I would both agree that if more people used reason, did that work, understood themselves, figured out their shit, dealt with all their trauma, dealt with all their ego issues, their biases, tried to do all that, we're in a much better position to get to stable mutual actualization. But don't we still
have get to it?
You don't get to it. It's like
A vector. Like,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But is the problem not still that, let's say we could snap our fingers and everybody did that work. Everybody's now dealt with their shit, however we define that. This still leaves that question of like, okay, now what are we working to? What are we trying to achieve? Is it equality? Is it?
Well, hear me out, because we're just getting started. So first thing is, I don't believe, and this is all theoretical, but it's a working hypothesis, right? I don't believe everyone comes along for the ride.
Okay. Agree.
You know, at the time that humans split off in the cradle of civilization, where they went this way and they became these nomadic hominids that eventually became Homo erectus and Homo sapiens, there were chimpanzees and bonobos. And we still have chimpanzees and bonobos.
Okay.
Right. So I think very likely we're at the kind of evolutionary agitation point where species diverge from each other. Some people are innately programmed to not give a fuck and keep becoming primal. And some are like going, man, there's a tomorrow out there. Way. And I'm picking up the signal and it's lying that way somewhere.
I like
and
that.
And I don't see...
Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, man. Yeah, go for it.
Well, I was going to say, I like that. The dark side of that, because this is what this show is, right? When I like things, let's talk about them. Let's rip them apart. Let's understand them. There's a decision. There's a judgment in that to say, right? Let's just use you and I. Maybe Rocco, you are capable of that evolution to get to that next stage. Let's just say I'm not. That's kind of a dark thing to say. Hey, there's some, like, because somebody can make the argument that state to try and reach that best possible state for humanity is that understanding and that compassion and love for everybody, that ability to actually care about other people as we care about ourselves. That's what allows us to be cohesive in the way we need to be. In what you're saying, which again, I think makes a lot of sense. There's this sense of like, well, certain people just aren't good enough to get there. Good enough, however you want to define that, not capable of getting there. And although it may be true, or like there's some darkness to that. Like, that doesn't mean it's not true. That doesn't mean you shouldn't buy into it, but
I think it's an anthropomorphized darkness.
Okay.
And it's kind of like, it's got an after stink of eugenics or something like that. Yeah, we don't like the idea of it. But at the end of the day, it's hard to argue on all fronts, given all the valences of enjoyment, experience, etc., that a chimpanzee and a bonobo are having less rich life experiences than you are.
Okay.
I think that's kind of, we imagine that. Look, it appeals to me more to have a human experience. And I don't think that the difference will be that tangible. It's just a thought experiment, and it's just a dangling a carrot. And at the end of the day, you know what the fact of nature is? Nature doesn't have the animal game, the power game, that status game, that dominance game. It doesn't have feelings, and it doesn't have virtue and morals. It's just got a clash of wills that eventually bashes itself out and finds an equilibrium that we call natural homeostasis. And I'm not advocating for that kind of heartlessness. I'm saying we are already confronted with that level of heartlessness and indifference. Mm-hmm. That is an ever-present reality. And if you are disposed in your actualization, as we all start discovering what makes us tick inside, mine won't be the same as yours. I don't want to become an impressionist painter. But what I do want to do is I want to try and reach people who seem unreachable in the service of bringing them along for a ride. That might be your vocation. And I believe there are people in the world that want to do that. And I want to free them up to be able to do that so they can reach the unreachable and bring as many along for the ride as we can. And that is also part of actualization. And if somebody says, fuck you, stop pushing your shit on me, who am I to eventually go, correct. So at some point in time, even if you're watching your kid make a choice that's going to break your heart, at some point in time, you have to honor their journey. At some point in time, you have to say, I can't make their choices for them for the rest of their life, because that actually isn't love. And sometimes you have to first make a pretty long mistake to learn your way. And I happen to believe, and I'm becoming more open to the idea, that the way we learn these lessons isn't just necessarily in the scope of a single human life. Now, I don't know that something like reincarnation does exist, but I do know that some of the issues that I live with psychologically, in the viscera, they're in the tissues, they weren't because of my past life. They were because of the baton of evolutionary bullshit that was handed forward. And I'm just the little bit of detritus that's riding on the top of the wave, spilling onto the beach. But I trail in my wake that experience. And in that matter, like, I'm still living with the sins and the baggage and the, as we all are. Now, you don't have to believe in reincarnation. Reincarnation doesn't have to be true for that point to be salient. Mm-hmm. And given that that point has salience, the perspective opens up where the life and trajectory of the species is in one way meted out in these tiny packets, these little quanta of experience, which we call our human life. But in another very broader perspective, excuse me, it's got this sort of arc, mm-hmm. of and it's not a straight line. It's a meandering, and sometimes we have to veer very far off course, actualizing in our own juvenile way to eventually realize this is a shit place to be. And our other part of our human nature will eventually make us lean back towards the communal fire. Mm. The problem is, the pendulum doesn't swing and come to rest in the middle. So we're veering off on these arcs. But while we're veering off on these little arcs in our individual life and conforming and veering and conforming, societies are doing this at a wider swing. Some other elements in the society are doing this. And then this greater arc of intentionality seems to be, and a lot of these counter motions are like all clashing in this moment that we're facing right now. And there's nothing that says in physics that you don't get one wheel on the tilt-a-whirl that just breaks the bolt and flies off and crashes. And that's the end of it. And as idealistically or optimistically intangible as some of these ideas might be, it's starting to become really salient or prudent for us to go, I don't know, but it's probably, if we're going to start like taking some of these things seriously, and I mean really seriously, not just say, hey, let's all throw our hats in the ring and have a, and okay, that was a shit idea, let's go on to the next guy to tear down. Like, can nobody raise their feet, their view from their feet or from the low horizon and just think, What could we become? What could we become? And if we don't look this moment in the face right now, we could become nothing, nothing. And if you can sit there and honestly live with that tragedy, this thing, this emptiness that plays out for the whole of existence for another 1 million years while the earth reboots another sentient species, are you just okay with that? You know, and a lot of people go, yeah, and then the arguments become circular. What can I do? And how do you expect this to work? I don't know. But I think there's great courage in asking these questions seriously and having these vulnerable conversations, because at the end of the day, I mean, you're a great person to have this kind of conversation with. And I know that you're asking questions, not to kick the legs out from my table, but hey, I want to eat from that table.
Yeah.
I need to make sure the legs are sturdy. Let's check it out. Now, this collegiate way of speaking, it's cost you nothing and me nothing. It's been a great investment. And it's probably one of the best conversations I've had this month. And when I mean a month, I mean the last 30 days. It's a epic conversation. But the reason we were able to do that was not because I know better or I'm cleverer, or it's because I give a shit about something. Mm-hmm. I took a lot of time and energy to articulate this in a way that is cohesive and coherent mm-hmm. and actually tracks onto reality and doesn't just hop, skip, and leapfrog over unpretty facts about humans and where we're headed and what we're doing. And you are like, yeah, okay, hit me.
Mm-hmm.
We can do these. We can do these things. And it begins with two people. And do you know what a murmuration is?
Yeah, that's birds. When birds.
That's right. That's yeah. right. You know, when they were making the movie Gladiator, Ridley Scott said, oh, okay, I want these aerial shots over the Colosseum and I want to see these birds flying everywhere. And the designers were going like, fuck, how am I going to 3D animate a flock of birds? There's hundreds of these things. So they spoke to ornithologists and to people that knew what they were talking about. And they said, it's actually not so complicated. There's two things that birds do. They don't crash into the bird in front of them or next to them, and they don't steer too far away from the bird around them. And so there's this elastic tension, but no one bird is deciding the direction. Although many of the birds have a shared response to updrafts or to light signal or... So there is a pattern, but it's not rigid. And all it takes is one bird to catch an insect on the wing and veer half an inch. And the six around it move like this. For no reason. They just, that's what we do. I wasn't thinking about it. I didn't process it. And then the 100 around them all just move. And if you can get enough thinkers of good mind to wake up inside the swarm, inside the flock, and go, I have an idea. Let's just try this. And they all move in a certain way. And eventually, we are trained like herds to notice things that, what was that? Curiosity. What is this? And before they can even become angry, the angriness comes later. Curiosity is there. And if you have a ready answer, both for the curiosity and for the woke that will come, because somebody will come after you because they can manufacture an insult out of anything, because it's an entrepreneurhood of entrepreneurship of victimhood. If you've got ready answers to say, well, we did this and we played with this other Lego block of humanity, our consciousness, our awareness, our reason, and we did this. Yeah, but what's your intention? Well, our intention is we want to get off this track. There must be, you know, whatever train track we're going to ride is the one that we're laying today. So let's work that out. Some people will be interested and galvanized and be captured by that. And then the woke, you can say, no, it doesn't do this. No, we don't think we're better than you. No, we're not trying to do eugenics. No, this is not a black-white issue. No, we don't think that you shouldn't be taken care of psychologically, be taught how to process your triggers and generational trauma. And I'm sure that you feel unsettled and fluid, and it's a very uncertain time for everyone. All the signals are all cockamamie. I have compassion for where you are, what you need, but I cannot pretend that your problem is the biggest problem. I can't do that. because I'm an adult and I know that if I went back 200 years ago and I asked, I don't pick a group as large as you like and ask them, what are their biggest problems for survival, for the well-being of their children? I don't think your sexual orientation or the pronouns that you want to call yourself or any of these ideological issues are going to come anywhere in the top 100 of those issues. They're going to be about food, shelter, wellness, opportunity. And so it's not as if there's one issue. I think there's a landscape of peaks and troughs. And somehow we've got a navigation problem. We're going to try and hit as many of these peaks as possible. But we've also got a coordination problem. How are we going to get enough people to value enough? You can't reason somebody out of something they didn't reason their way into. And you can't make somebody who doesn't value anything about your cell job.
Let me say this, Rocco, as we come to the agenda, maybe last question, last point, and then I'll give you the last word. You said something at towards the beginning of that of like, I can't understand why we can't rise above, which I get. It resonates very deeply with me. I think about that, the value of reason. I think you're the first person that said it, which maybe is telling. but reason, logic, to me, that's God. That's what we should be serving, right? That's where it's at. I agree with that. So I often ask the same question, like, why can't other people see it, right? The politicians, the whoever it is that are arguing about the shoelaces rather than the finals game, all those things, right? But I can't help but wonder, like, maybe they are. Like, maybe they're doing it. Maybe they're wondering the same thing. Maybe they think, I am doing it. I am doing my part to try and make this world a better place. How can nobody else see that this is the right way? Just like you and I are sitting here saying, how can nobody see that this is the right path? And I don't know, like, A, is it possible that's true? I assume it has to possibly be true. And then what? Like, what if it goes back to that actualization point where their version of it, their version of how we fix this, they genuinely believe that is the right way and this is how we do it, and they just see the world differently, right? So it's not an issue where we just need people to realize. We just need them to care enough. We need them to rise up to a level to try and fix this. It's that we genuinely, at our base level, have different views about how we actually fix it. What do you do then?
Yeah, okay, well, that's a hypothetical question, and sure. Let me kick the legs completely out from underneath that. So,
beautiful.
You're familiar with the story of the child drowning in the shallow pond. It's a thought experiment.
No, not.
It's a man walking on his way to work, and he sees a child drowning in a shallow pond, and he gets stops, and he wants to help the child, but he's got this counteractive impulse to not do it for a bunch of various logistical reasons. To hear his reasons makes some sense, and he is actually prioritizing his child in a very strange roundabout way. But it doesn't really matter how much you articulate his reasons, his dentist appointments, the fact that he didn't want to get his shoes wet because he wouldn't be able to make the meeting and therefore he wouldn't be able to pick his own child up and get to the optometrist, whatever. It doesn't actually matter how much biography you add to his, he just comes across as a moral monster. And yet we do this all day, every day. I don't know what city you live in.
New York.
Okay. So the homeless problem, the corruption problem, we are walking and looking away from need, real need all the time. We're doing it all the time. Right. And if you show somebody, this is unfortunately science and an unfortunate fact about human nature. If I show you a picture of a little girl in the Congo, whose family, you know, she hasn't got fresh water. And you tell me her name and a little photograph of her, and she's like play acting, trying to, you know, show how she's one day going to become a doctor. It just moves your heart. And if you show this video to 1,000 people, 800 of them are going to take out their checkbook and go like, how can we help? The fact of human nature, and they discovered this, unfortunately, when charities were trying to garner support from the Western mindset, as soon as you introduce a picture of her brother, that compassion reduces. Now, this, the more faces you add, eventually it becomes into the realm of not my problem. Like there's a genocide happening, couldn't bat an eyelid, but that little girl, oh my God, let's send money. Now, what happened? What happened was, there is a counterintuitive inverse relationship between some heartfelt need and problem versus the scale of the problem. As the problem scales, your I give a shit factor wanes. You're not inhuman for doing that. You are human for doing that. That is built into you, because if you had to become a bleeding heart for every cause, you would be frozen, paralyzed by inactivity. So it's not great, but someone's got to come along and help us make it easy to give. And one of our best ways, theoretically, was, okay, you pay tax and you give it to us, and then we'll apportion this to all the people in need, even some to other countries. And sure, so we're assuming a game, we're assuming a paradigm, we're assuming a framework. And your assumption was, what happens if everyone's already doing that? Well, they're fucking not. Because if you look at what the conversation is on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok, on Facebook, you are looking at the virtual showcase of what people care about, and it's nothing. It's nihilistic self-interest. It's very shallow.
And that's where reason comes in. Reason forces them to face that. If we use reason, if we actually access that part of our brain, it's hard to ignore that fact. Is that the...
Yeah, if you sit and explain an individual person what I've just explained to you now, a lot of people will like snap awake and go, yeah, wow, okay, I get that. Sometimes you have to use different gambits to reach people, because you're reaching around the clogged up furniture in their dark house, which is all their psychological detritus baggage, their shape of how the world works, who's coming for them. And depending on where they live on that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, a bum in the street, he doesn't care how he looks. He doesn't care about his social and esteem needs. He cares about where his next meal's coming from and where he's going to sleep that night. So our valence for these things that we attach to certain merits or values, they change given our state of survival, our state of arousal. And when vigilance and tribalism is activated and aroused, it doesn't go offline by itself. And it quite happily picks up invalid targets. And eventually you're just hyper aroused and vigilant of everything and everyone. And then there's no reason. I mean, story is literally where reason comes to die. And what everybody's caught up in is a story. Now, the challenge is, in the framework of my story, if I believe the way that you said, Terry, and you believe that actually I'm doing the best I can. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to become a Democrat politician. I'm going to run for office. And then very soon, I'm going to get caught up in this maelstrom of live theater that we call politics. But I'm going to tell myself every day I'm enduring all of this because this is my way of helping. Now, you and I can sit here and look at the education system and say, yeah, man, this is a joke. You're teaching kids the most useless things. Even if they go to university, you're teaching them a course for something that the real world is rendering redundant within 6 months. I mean, something's wrong. Something's wrong. And if you could, I'm not saying we're better than all the educators in the world, but if we had to sit on a weekend, the two of I, and just work out what's a curriculum for a bunch of kids, I would much rather send my children through that curriculum that you and I come up with than the one that they're doing at the moment. Why does the shit one still exist? It exists because everybody's climbing a ladder and trying to prove and validate through their effort and activity. So once I've invested 4 years and I wake up to that realization, or somebody throws that accusation at me, but I'm still going for that superintendent role for my district schools, it's not in my interests to kick out the legs of this hierarchy that I'm trying to climb. So I just play ball. Mm-hmm. And that's how we end up with Christianity. And that's how we end up with our education system. That's how we end up with our bicameral two-party lobbyist fuck up that we've got at the moment. And it's because when you're in the game, if some player their whole life, they were poor and they learned martial arts and they eventually got a junior contract in the UFC, it doesn't matter how much you're screwing them around. That is their ticket. It's not in their interest to bite the hand. It's in their interest to play the game. And they're going to play the game until eventually they get one rare person like Francis Ngannou maybe gets near enough the top and goes, you know what? Fuck you all. Mm-hmm. Now, you need a few of those eventually banding together to say, oh my God, could this not be better? Are you telling me right now that boxer-sized Dana White's the best person to lead forward a sport that actually shows the best competitors proving their skills? Or is it another bunch of reality TV pageantry that's selectively engineered to create revenue? He's doing the right thing to get shareholder return, but he's duped millions of people into believing this is actual competitive UFC. The two people murdering each other in the ring for that 5 minutes, that's real enough. But the heuristics by which you set the challenges up, that was all just to make money. At what point in time do we think we're not getting the right deal out of this game? How far must it veer away? So they become experts at dribbling just enough value into the fights and then hyping the shit up on Twitter. And then this becomes the job. Do you think the job is really running the UFC or bullshitting the public?
Yeah.
Bullshitting the public. Now, I like the UFC. I like Dana White.
Yeah.
I like what he's done. I don't think he's a bad person. I think he's a human being. And human beings, when they aren't watching and they're not amenable to correction, and someone can't come and say, hey, Terry, that was not good, man. That's not cool. When you can't say that to another human being, when you become the person that's not amenable to correction, you are not one of the psychological adults, because then you can play the power game. And if you can play it better and more manipulatively than somebody else, you win. And we're all locked in the same status games. And these status games are driven, the little monkey at the lever is our primitive self from page 1 to page 999, not this page 1002 that says, this could be epically insane. This could be so insane. You just actually can't imagine the world we can live in because you lack the imagination. You haven't sat down long enough to think about some of it. But oh my God, can you imagine if even a critical mass of 20, 30% we're just pulling in the same or similar direction with a similar kind of heuristics. But you have to let go of your precious ideological, you know, your baby. Your baby's ears are on backwards, and it's not going anywhere.
Well, it's reason has to be your baby. Logic has to be your baby. That has to be what you worship, right? You have to say there's no idea, there's no concept, there's no belief that I hold higher than reason and questioning and logic. And back to your
man,
point,
you're
if it's
it.
Not working, then that's I adjust. It. That's got to be the God that we worship in so many ways. Rocco,
the way that I frame it.
Yeah.
The way that I frame it is to say there's no right way and no only way. But there has to be better ways and worse ways. And it stands to reason that we should always be amenable to better ways.
Yes. Yes.
That's a no loss scenario.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Oof, Rocco, this is super thought provoking, intriguing. I mean, you're a philosopher, right? So it doesn't surprise me that this is the type of conversation we have and that we should be having. And I think you've made a really, really strong case for the value that you started with of reason throughout this. I think it's messy. You've articulated that as well. It's not easy. There's nothing about this that but exactly the phrase you just said, you have to be amenable to the idea that there's a better way. If we can get to that start, even if 30% of people just accept that, I think
just that
bird formation starts shifting and it starts moving.
So, and we've got some great tools that we've come across. Agile is one of them.
True.
Some of the Greek dialectic of philosophy was another one.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some fantastic building blocks here to start putting together, like infinity stones. We can, there's a lot of ideas we can import from a lot of different places that can actually get us forward somewhere. And just to add a point on me being a philosopher, do you know, I didn't study. I've never walked into a university before. I don't have any degrees or any.
I think that would surprise a lot of people, but I don't think it's a prerequisite by any means to be able to think in the way you think.
In fact, it probably helped me enormously because, I mean, I'm not so daft as to compare myself to Da Vinci, but one of the reasons he was so free to move the way he did is because he was robbed of a classical education. And thank God. So, because otherwise I might have been indoctrinated into one of those games that aren't going anymore.
Oof, Rocco, I appreciate you a ton. I think it's awesome. I have links, as I mentioned in the intro, to your work and what you're doing and all the stuff. So if you're intrigued by this, if you think, hey, there's something to it, check it out. And I hope you do, in whatever form it is for anybody listening. I think that's the point we're both trying to get across, is we don't have the answers, but the belief that there's a better way and the acceptance to entertain, maybe it's different than the way you're doing it right now. That's a big part of it. So I thank you a ton for what you're doing and what you're trying to bring into the world.
I really appreciate you. I really appreciate the time that you've taken and the quality of questions you asked. It's
it takes two to make it work.
So refreshing. So refreshing.
Yeah. Likewise. All right. Well, you have an awesome rest of your day.
Yeah. It, stop recording and I'll.
Hey, thanks a ton for listening to the episode. I really do appreciate everybody that listens. And I think it's super cool that people want to hear conversations like this. They want to hear us talk about values and different perspectives and really just philosophical thinking. I'm kind of on this mission or journey to bring philosophy back to the forefront, maybe even make philosophy cool again, because I just think there's so much value in thinking about our thinking, questioning and challenging ourselves more, pondering these big picture questions about life. So in that spirit, I'm trying to expand that mission a little bit, and I created a Patreon account that would be awesome if you check out. I'll put the link in the show notes. It's pretty simple though. It's patreon.com/whatsthevalue. And the idea is for people that maybe want to learn more about philosophy, dip their toe in it a little bit, or maybe you already love it and just want to get more of it. Check it out, because there's kind of a tier for everybody. Whether you just want to get like a quick philosophical video or a thought of the day, maybe you want to email or text me some questions and get some thoughtful philosophical responses. Or if you want to have a live one-on-one chat over Zoom. We're even doing group discussions where we kind of do group philosophical debates and discussions and ponder some of those big questions. So check it out. See if it's something you might be interested in. As I said, I just love to bring more philosophy into our lives, and I thought this might be a cool way to do it. Whether that's your thing or not, and you're into Patreon or not, I really do appreciate a ton that you listen and check out these episodes. So I appreciate it greatly, and I hope you have an awesome day.